American, Canadian, and British troops have seized beachheads, which threaten to isolate the Normandy Peninsula, also to capture a railroad pointed straight toward Paris. It's now known that American troops have knocked out enemy pillboxes and other fortifications along the Atlantic Wall, using the intense striking power which has been assembled during these past weeks and months, if not years. In addition, the German news agency says that Allied forces have battled their way 10 miles inland from the coast of Normandy. And the Germans add that the most important airfields in the Normandy area have been wiped out. This time, those airfields are being wiped out for the last time. The air attacks on those fields may have been remedied, but this time, ground forces, heavily equipped, are taking over those airfields. Prime Minister Churchill reported on the progress of the invasion just 6 hours after the first waves of shock troops leapt from their landing craft, and after the first waves of paratroopers poured out of their great planes. Churchill told the House of Commons that upwards of 4,000 ships and thousands of smaller boats crossed the English Channel to begin the attack on the enemy's fortress Europe. One can only imagine the scenes on the English Channel as those thousands of ships, large and small, streamed across those waters towards the enemy shore. We've already had reports that thousands of planes are in operation. Churchill said the Allies can draw on the amazing total of 11,000 first-line planes if need be. One need only recall our first bombing efforts from Britain, utilizing no more than a few hundred planes, to visualize what this must mean, to visualize what it must mean in terms of tonnage of bombs now being dropped upon the enemy. It's doubtful, it would seem, that the German resistance can stand up against this form of attack. Turning to today's operations, Churchill said, and we quote, "Obstacles which were constructed in the sea have not proved as difficult as was expected." One reason for this, of course, is that the Allies sent out a great flotilla of minesweepers, those small vessels which have the difficult task of clearing away mines. The Germans had mined the waters heavily, but these men of the minesweepers did their task efficiently and effectively. It's also clear now that the fire of shore batteries in the invasion areas has been largely silenced. Many of these Nazi shore batteries, as you know, were cleverly concealed. Germans have been working on them for months. But it does seem, and largely no doubt because of the use of our great battleships with their heavy guns pouring forth a steady rain of shells, largely because of this form of attack, we at last seem to have managed to silence some of these shore batteries at least. Prime Minister Churchill continued, as has been earlier reported, that massed airborne landings have been successfully effected behind the enemy lines, and that landings on the beaches are proceeding at various points at the present time. It's not surprising, of course, that we are seeing this extensive use of airborne troops. It's been known for a long time that we would employ this ultimate of modern warfare, and we have assembled in Britain great numbers of these paratroopers using the most modern of weapons. Their task, of course, is to get behind the German lines if possible, to wreck communications, to destroy German fortifications wherever possible. And it does seem from these reports that the paratroopers are doing their job. Churchill also said, and we're still quoting, "There already are hopes that tactical surprise has been achieved." If true, this undoubtedly will prove to be one of the most significant parts of the invasion. For the Germans have had plenty of time during these past months to anticipate the aim and direction of Allied strategy. They have boasted that they knew exactly what we were going to do. They have claimed to be fully prepared. But in Churchill's words, it does seem that some tactical surprise has been achieved. So far, Churchill went on to say, the commanders who are engaged have reported that everything is proceeding according to plan. Here's another bulletin which has just come in. More than 640 naval guns, ranging from 4 to 16 inches in size, are bombarding the beaches and enemy strong points in support of landing forces. This is a remarkable indication of the extent to which sea power now is ranging alongside air and land power in this final assault, this greatest military adventure in history. It's been known for a long time that our Navy has been assembled for this task. But here, and I repeat the figures, more than 640 naval guns, ranging from 4 to 16 inches in size, now are steadily shelling the beaches and the enemy strong points along that 100-mile stretch of Normandy coast where the Allied forces have landed. And here's a report just in. The Paris radio said today that the battle on the continent, that is on the Normandy Peninsula, seems to be gaining depth. In other words, here is an admission from the enemy side that we are going ahead. Here's an interesting report from London. A few hours after the Allied invasion was announced, long queues of blood donors appeared outside transfusion depots in cities throughout England. The donors presented themselves in accordance with a prearranged plan to begin supplying a stipulated number of bottles of blood for the invasion forces in addition to their normal supply. It calls attention to one apparent fact, that is, that the invasion is going to cost us heavily, of course, in casualties, depending in the long run on how much resistance the Germans manage to offer. And now for a recapitulation. Churchill. I repeat, here is a recapitulation of Churchill's talk. Prime Minister Churchill told a cheering House of Commons today that the Allied liberating assault upon Hitler's European stronghold was proceeding according to plan. And he added, what a plan. Churchill was confident. He reported that the Allied forces had been transported across the Channel to the shores of France by an immense armada of 4,000 ships with several thousand smaller craft, probably, said Churchill, the greatest fleet ever assembled. Churchill's also called attention to the fact that mass airborne landings have been successfully effected behind the enemy's lines. There are already hopes, he said, that actual tactical surprise has been attained. And, he said, we hope to furnish the enemy with a succession of surprises during the course of the fighting. The battle which is now beginning, Churchill warned, will grow constantly in scale and in intensity for many weeks to come, and I shall not attempt to speculate upon its course. Every report now coming in indicates that the actual air attacks upon the continent have hit a new high peak, with constant streams of bombers of every description dumping their loads on this chosen coastal area where our troops are attacking. French patriots have been warned by Allied radios to withdraw to a depth of at least 22 miles from the coast.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the National Broadcasting Company. We want to speak to you a moment about the program that was scheduled at 8 o'clock, the overseas broadcast, in which you are to hear Stanley Richardson, the Navy, and Merrill Muller, our reporter at Eisenhower's headquarters. This broadcast failed because of technical difficulties, but we have been advised that the broadcast will take place in just 2.5 minutes at 8:25. So we suggest that you stay tuned here to NBC when we bring you this special broadcast of Stanley Richardson and Merrill Muller. And now again, Mr. Peterson.
In just a matter of seconds, as you've heard, we'll return to London for further direct details of the invasion. Meantime, here is some news from the other fighting fronts. In Italy, Fifth Army troops are driving steadily beyond liberated Rome. Some units have advanced as much as 5 miles from the River Tiber. They're meeting what's officially described as only weak resistance. French troops have captured Tivoli on the Avezzano Highway, 30 miles northeast of Rome. And so, with the news of the invasion electrifying the entire world, there's new attention also to what the Russian armies now will do. The Germans are still attacking north of Yassi in Romania, trying to block a Red Army offensive in that area. We have had no reaction from Japan as yet. But it's clear that the Japanese now will intensify their campaign to break up the Chinese war effort. Gradually, the results of the invasion will have their effect around the entire world. The Germans have already admitted the loss of some of their airdromes, and others, as we've already reported, have been knocked out by our air attacks and also by our land forces. German news dispatches claim that at least 4 Allied airborne divisions landed between Le Havre and Cherbourg, and that heavy fighting is underway around Cannes, some 8.5 to 10 miles inland. The Nazis also declare that Allied glider formations have been observed which seems like understatement, considering the announcement in London that up to 4 divisions already are in active operation.
The National Broadcasting Company, through its own reporters, where the news is made, through its monitoring of enemy and neutral broadcasts, through the worldwide facilities of the great news-gathering agencies, will bring you all the invasion stories first and as they happen. For a special broadcast now, we take you to London.
This is London. We now take you to a point on the English coast for the first eyewitness of the naval action. It is by Stanley Richardson.
We're having slight technical difficulties in establishing...
Hello, New York. We're encountering slight technical difficulties. We will hope to go ahead in just a moment or two.
Stand by, if you will, ladies and gentlemen. We're waiting for them to establish contact.
Unable to establish contact with our remote point, so we must conclude this portion of the broadcast from London. We will call in the New York broadcasters again when we are prepared to go forward with this broadcast. We return you now to the United States.
And here again is Elmer Peterson with a roundup of the news.
Our own reports so far indicate that German naval activity has been negligible in the English Channel. The Germans, however, say that a furious sea battle has developed off Le Havre between Nazi motor torpedo boats and the invasion fleet. The Germans also claim to have scored numerous hits on Allied warships, and Allied transports at sea. All these claims, so far, are without confirmation. It is to be expected, of course, that the Germans will use whatever navy they have left, especially their motor patrol boats and probably small submarines, in their efforts to block the invasion. Their only chance is to cripple the supply line across the English Channel. It also remains to be seen whether the Germans, as has been predicted, may attempt some sort of airborne landing of their own in Britain, some sort of desperate suicidal action in a final effort to break British railway communications directly from the fountainhead of the invasion supplies and the source of invasion manpower. There's new attention, of course, to the American paratroopers. These men have been trained for a long time in Britain now, and the forces now being engaged on the continent are studded with battle-hardened veterans of the Sicilian and Italian campaigns. These are the men who have landed behind Hitler's Atlantic Wall now to strike the first blow of the long-awaited Western Front squarely at the very vital parts of the enemy defenses. These paratroopers are the toughest and wiriest men of the war. The actual sight, the actual scene of their assault almost beggars description as they cascaded from faintly moonlit skies in what must have been an awesome operation to watch. Large numbers of twin-engine C-47s, the sisters of America's standard airline flagships, carried the human cargo across the skies, simultaneously towing troop-laden CG-4A gliders. And all of this merged finally into a single sledgehammer blow, paving the way for the frontal assault troops. The paratroopers and our glider-borne infantry are armed with weapons ranging from the most primitive to the most modern. The paratroopers' mission, as I've said, is to disrupt and demoralize the German communications inside the Nazis' own lines. There is no immediate indication that their dynamite, their flashing steel, and their well-aimed fire was not succeeding in the execution of plans rehearsed for months in preparation for the liberation of occupied Europe.
This is the National Broadcasting Company in New York, and we are going to attempt once again to establish contact with Stanley Richardson and Merrill Muller. This special broadcast will come to you from London.
This is London. This is London.
Jan, we shall attempt to take you to a point on the English coast for the first eyewitness of the naval action. It is by Stanley Richardson.
Stand by, ladies and gentlemen. We are trying to establish contact, as you heard them say, in London. Go ahead, London. Go ahead, Stanley Richardson.
Difficulties with this transmission and must again abandon it, at least for the time being.
We return you now to the United States.
This is Charles F. McCarthy in the NBC newsroom in New York. The hour is at hand. The news the world has been waiting for is being made. Allied forces are moving inland, driving into the outer rim of Hitler's Fortress Europe from landings made earlier this morning on the coast of northern France. American, British, and Canadian troops, airborne and seaborne contingents, were successfully landed in a series of operations starting at midnight Eastern wartime and continuing for 2.5 hours. 4,000 ships and several thousand smaller craft took the main body of the Allied armies in. Earlier, deep penetrations had been made by parachute and glider forces. And a report from Prime Minister Churchill in London a short time ago says this, and I quote, "So far, the commanders who are engaged report that everything is proceeding according to plan." Allied leaders have not yet announced the locations of our landings. They want to use to the fullest extent whatever element of tactical surprise the Allies may have gained. But German broadcasts declare that our landings were made in Normandy, along a stretch of more than 100 miles of beaches that extends from Le Havre to Cherbourg. The Nazis say that the Allied aim is to seize the big ports of Le Havre and Cherbourg, as well as the airdromes of the Normandy Peninsula for a gigantic offensive. There is no denying the indication of gigantic operations. And NBC monitors picked up a British radio report a short time ago saying that our troops have moved at least 10 miles inland. We do know that the beachheads have been secured. That's an official bulletin just in from an 8th Air Force reconnaissance base. And the flyers have the pictures to prove those beachheads. They report that our men are slashing their way inland, but there's no official word yet on the extent of the advance. In addition to the support of warships for the Allied landings, 11,000 airplanes backed up the operation. Our Allied landing troops got their orders from the Supreme Allied Commander, General Dwight Eisenhower. The American leader issued his formal order in these words: "You are about to embark on a great crusade. The eyes of the world are upon you, and the hopes and prayers of all liberty-loving peoples go with you. We will accept nothing less than full victory." NBC listeners heard the first official announcement of the invasion at 3:32 o'clock. It was followed by the first communique and General Eisenhower's order of the day. Earlier, the German radio had filled the air with invasion flashes. The Nazi broadcasts emphasized the size and scope of the landing operations and indicated that Allied paratroops were holding positions nearly 9 miles inland. The first Allied fighter pilots to return from flying over the beachheads report that our infantrymen were scrambling up the shores of France at 7 a.m. British time, 1 a.m. Eastern wartime. Apparently, they met no heavy opposition, at least in the early stage of the assault. In charge of the landing operations was the British leader, General Sir Bernard Montgomery. The Allied units leaped onto the shores that Hitler's leaders have spent nearly 4 years in fortifying. Our men struck out as Allied planes and ships hurled terrific barrages into those vaunted Nazi defenses. The forces thrown into the operation were by far the greatest ever used in an amphibious assault. All night long, London and other English cities resounded to the roars of thousands of airplanes, some carrying bombs, others carrying men. Returning RAF bombers met big fleets of flying fortresses on their way out. During the 48 hours previous to the landings, RAF and American bomber fleets dropped a staggering and devastating tonnage of bombs on the West Wall's defenses. One of the most difficult things on this D-Day is for us at home to grasp some idea of the immensity of the operations. Certainly, it is the greatest battle, the greatest military feat of all time. Prime Minister Churchill, in his report to the House of Commons, says as much, describes the mighty armada that sailed against the coast of France as the greatest assemblage of ships ever to sail together. 4,000 fighting ships, ships of war, and many thousands of landing craft besides. And to sustain the operations, 11,000 aircraft. 11,000. Certainly a number that staggers the imagination. And then the Prime Minister utters these significant comments. Says he, "The battle which has now begun will grow constantly in scale and in intensity for many weeks to come. I shall not speculate on its course, but this I may say. Complete unity prevails among the Allied armies. There is a brotherhood in arms between us and our friends of the United States." And then the Prime Minister makes the first report on the overall progress of the battle. There are already hopes that actual tactical surprises has been attained. Churchill says, "And we hope to furnish the enemy with a succession of surprises during the course of the fighting." And as the eyewitness accounts come back from the front, we get this picture of the Allied soldier.
This is the National Broadcasting Company. We take you now to London.
American war correspondent Stanley Richardson has just returned from the second front beachhead with the first naval eyewitness of the operation. Mr. Richardson.
I've just returned from the channel approaches to the coast of France, where I was privileged to watch the opening phases of the largest scale military invasion operation in history. My ringside seat was the heaving deck of a United States Naval Patrol torpedo boat, on which I traveled across the channel with the first contingent of a naval task force. This force was composed mostly of American units. From the time we left the British coast until we were within a short 2 or 3 miles of the French shore, our naval units encountered no enemy opposition whatsoever.
That, perhaps, is the outstanding fact
that I brought back with me. Altogether, my squadron of PT boats was in the channel for about 20 hours. We covered scores of square miles of rolling, choppy sea. We were patrolling and acting as escort for literally hundreds of slower-moving vessels of all descriptions. Many of them had been at sea longer than we had, but the Germans either were taken completely by surprise or just were afraid to come out and challenge us. Not a recognizable enemy plane appeared overhead. At least no bombs were dropped at or on any of the ships in our area. No low-flying fighters came over to strafe us with machine gun fire. And no enemy vessel, not even one of their vaunted E-boats, came out to the attack. The officers and men with whom I rode wondered searchingly about this. They had been keyed up for some real German opposition, both from the air and the sea. Their trigger fingers were itching for a scrap, and they were a very disappointed lot at not getting it. If the Germans weren't just too timid to come out, the only other ready explanation that could be advanced was that they were too busily engaged in coping with the Allied air attacks made on their shore establishments as a prelude to the actual landing of troops. In the area we covered, we could see hundreds of bombers and fighters shuttling back and forth, dropping their bomb loads and returning to England for more explosives to blast the enemy. And we could see the big two-engined American transport planes, also in the hundreds, returning to their bases in the United Kingdom after dropping their airborne troops in France. Yes, Jerry had a lot to keep him busy last night and early today. But as far as the naval phase of our activity was concerned, not a shot was exchanged with the enemy while I was on the scene. For that preliminary phase of the show, at any rate, it was all too incredibly easy. We left our patrol torpedo boat based in daylight to accompany the slow-moving light advance guard of ships, which had to pave the way for the actual landing. One of our missions was to protect the Allied minesweepers, which cleared a wide channel straight to the enemy shore for our troop transports and supply ships. Long lines of ships of every description were discernible on the skyline, literally miles of craft in even columns converging upon the area in the channel marked for the concentration point for the actual invasion. Huge transports, tank landing ships, smaller troop landing craft, tankers and supply vessels of every kind plodded doggedly along under lowering skies and laboring over heavy seas. You people at home would have been thrilled to the bone to have seen all these American men, American ships, and American supplies sailing calmly into the action for which they had been prepared and trained for so many months. It was estimated that there were more than 4,000 ships of all kinds in the channel for this combined operation. By nightfall, we were nearing the French coast, and our watch tightened. But nothing happened. Even when a full, near moon, appearing fitfully from behind the clouds, gave our position away clearly to any enemy who may have been lying in wait for us. Then the fast and heavy combat ships moved up into position. All aligned themselves in the bombardment area to loose a hail of high explosives to protect the troops moving into the beaches on their landing craft. The warships started laying their smoke screen preparatory to shooting their guns. It was within only a few minutes of H hour of the long-awaited D-Day, and right there was where I got the biggest disappointment of my life. We turned around and headed back at high speed for the English coast. Our PT squadron was under orders to return to base and refuel for another mission as soon as its first operation was completed. So I didn't even hear the bombardment begin. But I can tell you that if things are going as well now as they look to be going at the time I left the scene, it won't be long before our troops have a firm foothold. And now here is Merrill Muller at the advance command post of the Allied forces. This is Merrill Muller reporting from the advanced Allied command post of the invasion forces. Operations toward the liberation of Europe commenced just a few hours ago. Thousands of ships, both in the air and on the sea, and armies of men are in motion fighting the greatest military amphibious undertaking in history. The whole thing started moving when one man pressed a theoretical button some hours ago. That man was the Supreme Allied Commander, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, who thinks of himself modestly as a Kansas farmer. Every evening, General Eisenhower gathered his staff around him in his secret headquarters, studied their faces, and asked their opinions. A gale had already roughened the channel, but the staff was confident on the wind, tide, and weather of today, soothing an amphibious assault upon Europe. That was it. General Eisenhower wished his command his luck, and the great undertaking then and there began to unfold. The finest collection of military minds in the United Nations had created a plan they considered complete. Every possible contingency had been thought of. A tremendous mass of the greatest military equipment ever devised had been pooled by the Allied attacking forces. A bombardment, the likes of which the world has never seen, was ready to open. Everything that could humanly be done had been done up to the point when General Ike pushed the button. The campaign thus passed to the direction of God and the hands of the common soldier. Early Monday morning, as the huge invasion force made last-minute preparations, General Eisenhower checked his decision again with his staff. The word was still go. Good weather was the prediction for H hour, D-Day. The dominating air support depends on good weather even more than the Allied navies. While landing craft of all types swung in and out of convoys,
to check their loadings and replace used fuel, General Eisenhower was busy doing the things he wanted to do, the only things he could do.
Visit his troops.
As H-Hour D-Day approaches, there is nothing more tactically useless than a supreme commander, except as an inspiration.
General Ike is certainly that. I have never seen him more popular with his troops. I have never seen any commander receive greater acclaim or buoy his men more than does General Eisenhower.
One British battalion cheered him as they clanked aboard their fast landing barge. He waved a friendly hello, and that broad grin lit up his face, a face that showed nothing but confidence in his men. A face in which fatigue is miraculously erased whenever it mirrors the allied esprit de corps and the fighting spirit of the little men with rifle and bayonet. He came back from the port full of a sense of victory. No finer force ever went into battle with a better spirit or with greater courage than this one that General Eisenhower heads. In visiting with Royal and American Navy landing craft and with the allied troops they will carry, the general had been given a lift. Some of his own nervous tension had been relieved. So he arrived at our hidden camp to meet the four correspondents attached to his staff. If I never attend another press conference in my life, I shall certainly remember this one. Perhaps because its outstanding factor was that it was more like a staff conference than a general's talk to newspapermen. Here's the picture. Remember that all around us, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of men were readying themselves for the outbreak of the battle that all the world had waited for four long, dark years.
Ladies and gentlemen, the prayer of the President of the United States. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness to their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. The enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come with rushing speed. But we shall return again and again. And we know that by thy grace and by the righteousness of our cause, our sons will triumph. They will be sore tried by night and by day without rest till the victory is won. The darkness will be rent by noise and flame. Men's souls will be shaken with the violences of war. These are men lately drawn from the ways of peace. They fight not for the lust of conquest. They fight to end conquest. They fight to liberate. They fight to let justice arise and tolerance and goodwill among all thy people. They yearn but for the end of battle, for their return to the haven of home. Some will never return. Embrace these, Father, and receive them, thy heroic servants, into thy kingdom. And for us at home, fathers, mothers, children, wives, sisters, and brothers of brave men overseas, whose thoughts and prayers are ever with them, help us, Almighty God, to rededicate ourselves in renewed faith in Thee, in this hour of great sacrifice. Many people have urged that I call the nation into a single day of special prayer. But because the road is long and the desire is great, I ask that our people devote themselves in continuance of prayer. As we rise to each new day, and again, when each day is spent, let words of prayer be on our lips, invoking thy help to our efforts. Give us strength, too, strength in our daily tasks, to redouble the contributions we make in the physical and material support of our armed forces. And let our hearts be stout to wait out the long travail, to bear sorrows that may come, to impart our courage unto our sons, wheresoever they may be. And, O Lord, give us faith. Give us faith in Thee, faith in our sons, faith in each other, faith in our united crusade. Let not the keenness of our spirit ever be dulled. Let not the impacts of temporary events, of temporal matters, of but fleeting moment, let not these deter us in our unconquerable purpose. With thy blessing, we shall prevail over the unholy forces of our enemies. Help us to conquer the apostles of greed and racial arrogances. Lead us to the saving of our country, and with our sister nations, into a world unity that will spell sure peace, a peace invulnerable to the schemings of unworthy men, and a peace that will let all men live in freedom, reaping the just rewards of their honest toil. Thy will be done, Almighty God. Amen. That is the prayer in which the President of the United States has asked us to join him as he leads us at 10 o'clock this evening over the radio. And now a few news bulletins that have just come in. A bulletin from London. The Nazi-operated Vichy radio reported tonight that compact masses, that's in quotation marks, compact masses of Allied planes are bombing the Calais and Dunkirk regions of the French invasion coast. That's some 125 miles to the east of the landings made at Le Havre this morning. It means that our beachheads are expanding, that we are going to different portions of the coast. Dunkirk, of course, and Calais are nearest to the English coast. The German radio reports that Allied paratroopers have landed just across the channel from England, there in the Boulogne-Calais area, that those paratroopers have occupied an enemy airdrome there. If that is true, and there is no reason to believe the Germans would put out a false report of that nature, it means an Allied invasion thrust directly across the Strait of Dover, 100 miles or more above that Allied beachhead area on the Norman coast. We have no confirmation of any invasion activity in this area from Allied headquarters as yet. But already we are expanding our beachhead there in Normandy. And in Stockholm, they're saying that Denmark has said today that German troops in the protectorate there have been ordered on an invasion alert since early this morning. And General Sir Bernard Montgomery says he is pleased with the initial phases of the invasion operations. General Montgomery heads the Allied armies, taking part in the landings, as you know. Montgomery was quite happy, as he told newsmen today, that he'd given his officers a 5-point recipe for victory just before the invasion began. The 5-point recipe for victory, Montgomery said, was this. 1, Allied solidarity. 2, offensive eagerness. 3, enthusiasm. 4, confidence. And 5, all-out effort. That's General Montgomery's 5-point recipe for victory. And in Washington, Secretary of War Stimson, with smiles on his face, told a newsman that first reports of the Allied landings in France indicated the long-awaited invasion was going very nicely. He's the second Washington official today to say that. Admiral King, chief of our navies, and a member of President Roosevelt's strategic board, said that when he left the president this morning. And we learn now that the Nazis are suppressing news of the progress of the invasion and withholding the facts from the German people. Radio Atlantic, which is a German secret transmitter, charged in a broadcast monitored this afternoon by NBC that the German propaganda machine was letting only a trickle of news out to the German people. What scant news is put out by the German home radio is very confused and depressing, and the people of Berlin have gathered in the streets in whispering knots, wondering where the next blow will fall. They know that by nightfall and the hours of darkness now ensuing will mean more landings. Where, they ask. Their prime question is where. The clandestine transmitter, located somewhere in Germany, states all this today. It is significant, says this radio station, which is called anti-Nazi, that though broadcasts beamed to Germany from England repeat the German claims of successes in naval engagements in the Channel, the Reich radio has made no such statements. It has not claimed that Allied ships were sunk in the Channel. The German radio knows, people know only too well the deplorable state of their fleet. They recall the sober statement of a high Nazi naval official that they are up against the strongest fleets in the world. And in Washington, Henri Opinot, the delegate of the French Committee of National Liberation, says that French divisions soon will participate in the Battle of France and that French shock troops will help to open the road to Paris. The road from Le Havre, we suppose. Side by side with American and British divisions, French divisions armed with the magnificent material given to them by the United States soon will participate in the battle. French soldiers will fight tomorrow, as they have fought in Africa and in Italy, where by the side of the Allies they opened the road to Rome. Tomorrow they will open the road to Paris. And Prime Minister Winston Churchill received today this congratulatory message from Premier Stalin of Russia, of the Allied liberation of Rome. He said, I congratulate you on the great victory of the Allied Anglo-American forces in the taking of Rome. This news has been greeted in the Soviet Union with great satisfaction. Those are the words of Premier Stalin. And the Berlin radio reports tonight that big air battles have developed over Romania today between Nazi fighters and bombers of the Allied Mediterranean Air Force. Soon we may expect the Russians to be on the push there. This news is brought to you from the NBC newsroom in New York by your commentator, Don Goddard.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.